Hey, Kev, let's follow this trail over here. This looks like there might be something waiting down there.
All right. Hey, wait a minute. Do you hear that?
Yeah, I thought it was just me. What the heck is that?
I don't know what that is. Whoa, do you smell that too?
That's unbelievable. Hey, look.
What the?
Hey, look, those branches are moving over there.
What the heck is that?
Holy cow, is that what I think it is? Look at that thing.
Oh my god.
It's a freaking Sasquatch.
Welcome to the Bigfoot Terror in the Woods Sightings and Encounters podcast. My name is W.J. Sheehan, author of the series of books, Bigfoot Terror in the Woods Sightings and Encounters. All 12 volumes, soon to be 12, 11 volumes to date, available in paperback, ebook, and Audible format at Amazon, iTunes, and Audible. And 12 is just about ready to pop, so keep your ears open for that. You know I'll tell you when it's ready to go. And may I introduce you to my brother and co-host of this fabulous podcast, KJ Sheehan. Kev, how are you?
I'm doing great, Bill. I'm back amongst the living after fighting influenza A.
Yeah.
They didn't get me yet, but they tried.
Influenza A for atrocious.
Oh, my goodness. That was bad.
Oh, my God.
That was a rough one.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, some of these can just kick you. Let's leave it at that.
Yeah, definitely.
But definitely. You sound better. And folks, you folks that are regular listeners know we missed our last weekend, but Kev was really sick. And we have limited times when we can get together to begin with. And top that off with Kev getting this bug that just kicked the snot out of him. That's why we couldn't put anything together. But we're back.
We're back. And sometimes, folks, we have them in the bank. We got them saved up and we can draw upon them. But the bank was empty.
Funds
to draw upon.
Funds are low.
But we're back in action. My voice should hold out for the podcast, which is good. It'll be no worse than normal.
What are you trying to say?
I'm just saying, you know, I'm not really a radio voice, you know. It's all good. It's
okay, all good. Man. What do you got in Cryptids in the News and Other Oddities segment today?
Yeah, we got an interesting one here, Bill. It's in the cryptid category. It scores high on what I would call the weird index.
Okay.
But this one is kind of, I think of it, some of these cryptids, they're about giving you the ability to fill out your cryptid bingo card. Here's another one for you.
Okay.
Or to give you another cool cryptid to talk about at your next boring cocktail party.
Hey, how often do you bring up cryptids at a cocktail party?
Not that often.
Yeah, I was going to say, you know.
Not you might that be, often.
You might be met with a wink and a nod.
Oh, yeah. Once in a while, someone will go down the path not knowing what my alter ego is.
Yeah.
And they are a little blown away that I know so much about the pig man and the goat man.
Hey, by the way, you look a little bit like a pig man.
And, of course, the black-eyed children.
Yeah. It's a little weird when people find out what you like to do on the side, you know. But, you know, I'm kind of used to it at this point, you know.
And speaking of a little weird,
mm-hmm.
We're going to talk about a cryptid that comes from around the western side of the state of Maryland.
Okay. The western side?
Yeah.
Okay.
And first talked about by some German settlers. We'll talk about that. But it has an origin in a German name. And that German name is Schnellergeist.
Schnellergeist?
Schnellergeist.
The Germans have such cool names, you know.
Exactly.
And I'm sure Philip, when he listens to this podcast, will give me the literal translation and the background on Schnellergeist, won't you, Philip?
Oh, and I actually know what the translation is, mon frère.
Okay. Lay it on me.
It is quick ghost.
Quick ghost.
Schnellergeist.
Schnellergeist. Well, that makes sense, because when you say mach schnell, it means like pronto, get with
it. Exactly. Get with moving. It. Vamos.
Vamos, Jackson.
So good old Schnellergeist. But, you know, quick ghost doesn't really do it well in the description, as you'll see.
Okay.
Although I like saying Schnellergeist.
Yeah. say it again, would you?
Schnellergeist. Would you mind if I borrow your telephone?
The Schnellergeist has a little brother with black eyes. Oh, my God.
And in America, of course, you know, as we started to change the translation, we started to call it a Snallygasta.
Oh, now that I've heard of, the
Snallygasta. You have heard of the Snallygasta.
Yes, yes.
Well, there you go. Schnellergeist.
But Western Maryland, I'm waiting to hear what the connection is with Western Maryland.
Well, that's just where they started being cited. So, okay. You know, one of the articles that I came across in the Montgomery County Sentinel in Rockville, Maryland.
Okay.
On December 2nd, 1932, it says, it has been 23 years since the dreaded winged monster, the Snallygaster, has appeared in the western section of Maryland with a wingspread of at least 30 feet,
wow,
reaching out its tentacles like some prehistoric inhabitant of the Miocene age. The Snallygaster, or winged Vovalopus, has been seen by 20 residents of Washington, Frederick, and Upper Montgomery counties within the past 2 weeks.
20? That's 40 people.
Yeah.
Wow. 30-foot wingspan?
Yeah.
You see, now, when we go back to talking about the guy who supposedly took the bridge down,
The Mothman.
Nobody described a Mothman with 30-foot wings.
No, or tentacles either.
Right. So the wings on the Mothman were kind of incidental because they certainly weren't big enough to put something aloft that supposedly had the size body the Mothman did. So
I think it was like 10 foot, something like that. I mean, I think it's possible.
Yeah?
Depending on how much the guy weighed, you know.
Well, let's just say he was a Mothman that was on the porky side.
Yeah, you know, if he spent a lot of time eating fast food, that might not be enough for him.
You scale people out of their vehicle where they're parked, and you sit down in the front seat and eat all their Mickey D's.
There you go. Yeah. Then after a while, he might be like, you know, these wings aren't quite big enough. I'm not getting the lift I used to get.
Failure to lift.
Yeah.
But go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, so that came back in 1932.
Wow.
After being silent for 23 years, having no reports. And then, like you said, 40 people saw this beast. And, you know, some of the other descriptions go back so into the 18th century. So in Frederick County, Maryland, same area, was settled by German immigrants beginning in the 1730s, and early accounts describe the community being terrorized by a monster called the Schnellergeist.
But there, we're talking, the word, the literal translation, as you put it, was like fast ghost.
Yeah, quick ghost.
So the connection between a ghost and something being seen and identified as having 30-foot...
I don't see the connection, you know, but that's what they called it.
Right. I gotcha. Yeah. Just so I know where my thinking is going, you know?
No, and they got some more description here. So okay. In this same description. They say the earliest incarnations of the creature mixed the half-bird features of a siren with the nightmarish features of demons and ghouls.
Wow.
The Schnellengeist was described as half-reptile, half-bird, having a metallic beak lined with razor-sharp teeth, occasionally alongside octopus-like tentacles.
What the heck?
Yeah. And it says that the Snallygaster was rumored to swoop silently from the sky to pick up and carry off its victims. The earliest stories claim that the monster sucked the blood of its victims. Yeah, and then apparently they would paint 7-pointed stars on the barns in the area. And apparently you can still see these stars in a lot of places because the stars would scare the Snallygaster away.
What's the significance of a 7-pointed star?
That I don't know.
Well, interesting, though. And we're talking early 1700s.
Yeah, 1730.
You know, and again, Kev, you know, my thinking always goes back to a day and a time when you could really look like a horse's ass amongst the local people if you were to start spinning a yarn like this, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
At what point was it that the 20 people saw it? What year range was that?
That was, I think it was 1932. Let me double check here. Yeah, 1932, December 2nd, 1932.
Right, still early on, you know, yeah. in the country's history, you know. What? That is just bizarre, man. This freaking metal-type beak with razor-sharp teeth, 30-foot wingspan.
And octopus-like tentacles.
That's the creepiest, like these things dangling from it, you know.
Figure that one out.
Well, who knows if they were actually like tentacles or something that appeared tentacle-like, you know?
Yeah, and they say sometimes.
Yeah, that's kind of weird. I don't know, man. It sounds like some other type of demon to me.
Yeah.
You know.
Definitely sounds demon-like, that's for sure.
Yeah, something you don't want to invite into your backyard. Oh, my God, the Snellygaster. Now, you know where I heard of the term Snellygaster from?
Down at the flea market last Saturday?
Yeah. That was the Snellygaster was ringing me up. Hi, my name's Snellygaster. Yeah. Let's make this a quick.
I got to use that for my next telemarketer calls me. I'd be like, Kevin, no, it's not the Geist. Would you like me to come and visit you?
Yeah.
Yeah,
look at my teeth, Fräulein.
You won't have to call anyone else after I visit.
You won't be able to.
That's what I got to start doing, answering the phone like a cryptid.
It might work, you know.
Sorry, no, this is Spring-Heeled Jack.
Yeah. Want to see me jump? Spring-Heeled who? Yeah, I do that. When I get those phone calls when it says potential spam,
yeah,
sometimes I pick it up and I say, oh, potential spam, I've been waiting for you, and they just hang up.
I like that, too.
Yeah, I just, you know, I can't get over on goofing on somebody, you know.
Yeah, once in a while.
So getting back to what I started to tell you, you know
what?
Yeah,
you were telling me where you heard of or came across the Snellygaster.
Yeah, you know where it was? On that crazy show Mountain Monsters when they were doing it.
Oh, okay.
I think they did one on the Snellygaster, you know.
Ah.
You know, they were running around the woods, stage and everything. You know, that was a very bizarre show. But I got a kick out of it, you know. It was like it's like watching the Three Stooges. Only there was more than Three Stooges.
So speaking of good shows, have you been watching the
Skinwalker?
They're back at the ranch?
Yeah, just incredible, man.
Incredible, right? Starting off with a bang?
Yeah. How about those two helicopters they had facing off above that triangle, and they couldn't send the radio beam through? I mean, they were spaced apart by what, 200 feet?
Well, yeah, and then worse yet, when what's his name, our favorite rocket scientist,
Travis Taylor
wanted to do like the control test, so he's just hovering 30 feet off of the ground in the triangle. And they're not receiving the signal either.
Yeah. I mean,
until he moves outside of the triangle and then goes, 500 feet away, and they can hear him fine.
Yeah. That is so bizarre.
It's weird
that something is blocking them there. But what I'm uncertain as to how if they'll ever be able to get to the bottom, or is it just going to be an ongoing experiment?
I mean, the plus side is, though, like, unlike a lot of these shows that just drag you along with little hints of something that might have happened,
mm-hmm.
I mean, the measurable effect of these experiments is very real and constant. You know what I mean? Like, they don't seem to have any episodes anymore. I mean, we'll see in the balance of this season where nothing significant happens. Like, it's like every episode is, like, action-packed.
Yeah, there's a lot of data flying around, and they're trying to just keep poking it and hitting it from all angles to try to make some sense out of it, you know. But what a bizarre, bizarre place that is, you know.
Yeah.
You know, and Kev, I got to tell you, and our listeners who are watching this this show, what I can't wrap my mind around is the fact that the U.S. government, in some capacity, was locked into that property for about a 10-year period.
Yeah.
And everything that happened there is either top secret or classified.
Yeah.
And so here's the question I pose. Why would you lock that joint up for a decade and then pull the plug and allow it to be sold to a privateer, so to speak, to do whatever they would with the property? And now, of course, this fellow hires this crew and he's publicizing the experiments now on the ranch. What do you make of that? Do you think that's just a farce? I don't know what to think about that.
Now, what do you mean? What do I make of what related to it?
Well, why would you have a place under wraps for 10 years doing all of these experiments? And I told you that George Knapp originally lured me into even knowing the term Skinwalker Ranch many, many years ago. Why would you just bail out and now allow this property to be sold privately?
Yeah, I mean, it's got to be that you're giving up on whatever was going on there.
You just had enough and said, we don't need this land anymore, and let it go.
Let it go. Yeah. Moving on. Or, you know, a budget gets cut, whatever. You know, all kinds of things could happen.
Right. Enough with the experiments over there. We're done.
Yeah. New administration, you know.
Right, right.
Blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, it's interesting, you know. But, I mean, I'm fascinated by this stuff, you know, as you know.
Yeah.
And it just keeps me coming back because I want to see. And there's plenty of UFO activity around there, orbs, things shooting around in the sky. There's a lot going on over there, you know, a lot of things. And listen, they have a lot of technology that they keep bringing to the table over there. So it's not like they're lacking with experimental models to run on different things, you know. I mean, they really are trying their darndest to get what they can and make some sense out of it, you know.
Yep.
But I don't know. I don't know if they're going to be able to make sense out of it, you know.
Yep.
But anyways,
I like it, though. I like it.
No, I love it. Is that it for the Snelligaster?
That's it for the Snelligaster.
Well, that was pretty cool. And now I've got a Bigfoot encounter here that's really strange. And, you know, by the way, folks, if you've seen something, say something. Go to BigfootTerrorInTheWoods.com. hit the contact link. I'll reach out to you and we'll have a conversation. This encounter happened in Saskatchewan, Canada, as you were about to hear. And so much for anybody who thinks that Bigfoot's afraid of the cold. Because as you're about to hear, man, this is one frigid day when this encounter occurred. So let me get on with it. Excuse me. This was told to me by a fellow named Walter Planchette of Canada. And one can only imagine what it must have been like to be there at the moment when he saw what he saw. And this is what Walter had to share with me. I had arranged a weekend several months in advance with a fellow named Wade, a well-known guide in Saskatchewan. He had been referred to me by my friend Jim, who had a successful hunt with him the previous year. So as the week progressed leading up to the weekend for my hunt, the weather was forecasted to be bitter cold and snowing. And as fate would have it, having awoken in my hotel room at 3 a.m. to get ready, it was worse than had been forecasted. So this guy was, and you'll hear, this was one nasty day. As I walked out the front door to start the truck and load my gear, the thermometer read 20 degrees below zero, and the snow was coming down in a torrent. I had about a 20-mile ride to where I would meet up with Wade, and there was zero cancellation policy by Wade or myself. In other words, if I canceled due to weather or sickness or anything, he already had the money. We met up at his house, which was on the fringe of a small community, and as I pulled up in the dark, I could see all the lights were on and the interior door was open. Wade was already coming out the door with some equipment, and as soon as we had transferred my gear into his truck, he invited me inside to review his game camera shots from the day before. He had a small countertop extension next to his kitchen table with a computer on it. And as we drank a cup of coffee, the two of us were getting a preview of some really nice bucks coming through the area of his blind. And then away we went. We drove well into this area. And after having parked the truck, it was about a 2-mile hike to the blind. And that was in whiteout conditions. Can you picture this, Kev?
Man, I'm cold sitting here.
Yeah, you got to really want to shoot a buck to put up with this. So he said, I was prepared, but still the cold and snow were unrelenting. Now, Wade's blind was primitive and had been constructed out in the middle of an irregularly shaped field of tall tan grass. The field was bordered in every direction with white birches, which on this day did not matter a lick because everything was white and getting whiter by the minute. The blind was made up of old stacked logs and was completely open at the rear, as well as only having a partial roof, if you could call it that. It looked like a U-shaped machine gun nest with snow packed up against it on three sides. As fate would have it that day, the wind was blowing along with the snow from the southeast, which was right into the open back end of this thing, and it was miserable from the moment we entered it. I just can't believe this. So now, there were two small openings on either side in the stacked logs, as well as a larger one in the front, which faced the game trail that these bucks traveled on a daily basis. I was bow hunting that day and was already wondering what it would be like to remove my gloves when it came time to shoot. So I was actually strangely hoping that I wouldn't have to. I was so chilled that even though I had just gotten there, I couldn't wait to leave. several hours into the morning, and a couple of really decent bucks had already gone by. But Wade somehow was unable to convince me to pass on them. Don't ask me how, considering what I just said to you, but I listened. Now, I screwed it up reading. We were several hours into the morning, and a couple of really decent bucks had already gone by. But Wade was somehow able to convince me to pass on them. Okay, so he didn't want him to shoot them. He thought something better was coming. Don't ask me how, considering what I just said to you, how I was considering what I just said to you, but I listened to him. About 7:30 a.m., a 4'8 that must have been 180 pounds or more was coming in from our right to our left. Walter had seen it through the right-hand window, if you will, but I, as of yet, had not, and was waiting for it to come into view. Planning for what I hoped would be the inevitable, I took my gloves off and placed an arrow on the nock in anticipation of the shot. About 45 seconds later, there it was, loping into my field of view, and I drew my bow in anticipation of letting the arrow fly. As I drew back, he lowered his head, and for whatever reason, he suddenly raised it and quartered away from me as I let go of the arrow. Instead of hitting it high and behind the shoulder, the arrow went through him at about mid-body, and he took off, out of my field of view and heading towards what we thought was the back of the field. Wade was already congratulating me, but I knew I had hit him in a potentially less than favorable spot and said that we'll probably end up having to track him for a bit. Now, under any other conditions, tracking blood in white snow makes things pretty easy, all things considered. But with the rate this snow was falling, if we didn't move fast and stay on him, his blood trail would be quickly covered in snow, and that would be that. So we left the blind and found his tracks fairly quickly as the snow being driven by the wind was pelting our eyes and our exposed faces. It was absolutely brutal, but we kept going. We rounded a corner, shielding our faces with our arms, and saw that his trail was leading away in what appeared to be across this large segment of the field, heading for the trees, and we followed. For the most part, our heads were down as we followed the tracks, and occasionally we looked forward, fighting to block the snow with our hands, when suddenly, Wade grabbed my arm, pulling me down with him as he squatted. He pointed forward towards the birches in the distance, and as I looked, there was a large black figure which appeared to be jostling what must have been my buck. We could distinctly see two contrasting colors of the buck's tan fur and what must have been a black furry arm around its body. I said to Wade, "Is that what I think it is?" And he said, "If you think it's a Sasquatch, yes." Where it had come from and how it had found my deer so quickly is anyone's guess. But neither of us was going to challenge it for the prize. And so we sat and watched. After about 60 seconds, if that, this Sasquatch stood to its feet, flipped the buck over its shoulders like a wounded warrior, and went into the trees. We watched it briefly, and then it was gone, along with my buck. Wade said to me that I had scored twice that day, once by hitting the buck, and then by seeing a Sasquatch. And I had to agree with him. I was so excited by having seen this monster that the loss of the buck and the snow didn't matter to me anymore. It was insane in every sense of the word. The buck, let me see, the buck, when it was in front of me, was pretty big. And yet when the Sasquatch had grabbed it to hoist it up, it seemed to be maybe 20% of the beast's size in comparison. This thing was jet black, with snow clinging to it everywhere. At about 100 yards, it had to be all of 9 feet tall and 1,000 pounds. By the time we made it back to the blind and grabbed our gear, the snow was beginning to let up, and Wade asked me if I'd like to warm up a bit and go track it. George wants to track the Sasquatch. This was a question which I didn't even consider to be answerable. Who in their right mind would want to track that monster with dinner on its back? So I told Wade, no way, and we left. This thing was so far off the charts, magnificent and frightening at the same time, that nothing can prepare you for seeing it, and yet we had. Truth be told, we both knew immediately what it was and what we had seen. There was no doubt about it. There was no second-guessing ourselves and no maybe this or that. It was enormous, two-legged, and hair-covered, and it was a monster that we know as Sasquatch. 2 days later, Wade called me and said that he tracked it for almost 3 miles through the trees after he had dropped me off with no end in sight and had broken off the track. Who knows how far this thing was going, and with a couple of 100 pounds of buck on its back to boot. What do you think of that, Kev?
Man, I'm still cold thinking about it. 20 below zero, and then they're bow hunting,
too. Bow hunting.
Holy moly.
So I guess this was one of those deals where, like, you reserve well in advance, and whatever it is, it's your time, you know?
Right. You don't know what you're going to get.
Yeah.
Otherwise.
I went out trolling for striped bass out at Montauk one fall, and we got out there just prior to sunrise. The surf was at 10 to 12 feet.
Ugh.
And we were off the point in this, like, 36-footer with a flying bridge and two fighting chairs in the back. And I'm telling you, man, this guy was timing it that the walls of standing waves were next to the back open end of the boat. And he just gave it enough gas so that they rolled behind us. And the lures were going, the umbrella rigs we were using would go through that surf. Man, it was freaking me out. But these guys up there, pelting snow, bitter freaking cold wind. And this Sasquatch shows up to grab the buck.
Mm.
Saskatchewan, man.
Yeah, that's a rural, wild place.
Yeah, and apparently the Bigfoot, I mean, how many times have we heard about, you know, Bigfoot grabbing somebody's buck?
Yeah.
It's got to be something they're familiar with. I think they kind of know what's going on, you know, or they're watching you even though you don't think they're there.
Yeah.
They see the animal get hit and run. There's got to be a familiarity curve there with what humans are doing and them observing. So Jeff, the guide from Colorado, when that place got shut down, he moved back to Tennessee. And you'll read in volume 12 the accounts from Jeff. And he and his hunting partner in Tennessee, they regularly hunt in the LBL, the land between the lakes.
Oh, yeah.
And they had one of his bucks and one of his friend's bucks, both were swiped.
Mm.
So you talk about something that knows what's going on. I mean, it's like they're watching them, they know what they're going to do, and they're waiting in earnest to let them take it down while they come and snatch it away. Very bizarre, huh?
Very bizarre.
So,
not as bizarre as the Snallygaster.
Man, that freaking Snallygaster is, like, sick. So that's it, man. That's the Saskatchewan Sasquatch.
I like it.
But I don't know. You could keep that, man. You know, and his friend Wade
goes back to track it and walked 3 miles. That's outbound, and he's got to come back 3 miles. And he said that the trail just kept going. So who knows how far this thing was going with the baggage, toting the baggage on his shoulders. Crazy, huh, Kev?
Really crazy. Really crazy.
Yeah. So there you have it. So what do we have in our listener mail today, bro?
Yeah, we got some good listener mail. This first one, I'll warn you, is somebody having a little fun with us, but I like it.
Okay.
Its title, let's see, who is it from here? I forget. From Robert.
Okay.
And Robert writes, it was the mid-70s. Mm-hmm. I was in Washington State, and I was camping after an all-day hike.
Mm-hmm.
Around 2 a.m., I was awoken by what sounded like some rustling on one of my tent poles.
Hmm.
I opened the tent door and saw 3 shadows around 4 feet tall. I ducked back in the tent and brought out a flashlight. There, standing in front of me, was 3 black-eyed Bigfoot children.
Oh, come on.
Telepathically, one said, excuse me, may we come in and use your sat phone? I ducked back in, grabbed my pistols, safety always off, by the way. I busted out like a Wild West villain yelling, I have no battery. What I do have is a hot lead injection. I emptied both clips and looked around. I didn't see them anywhere, so I yelled, when camping, I always carry more gun than I think I'm going to need. And he says, sorry for the fiction, or was it? I needed to laugh. Have a good one, Rob.
So evidently this is a tall tale being, as you said, Rob having a little fun with the Sheehan brothers.
I don't usually read the tall tales because we do get these, and I like the humor in that.
Yeah.
But this one really made me smile, and I guess I need a little smile after fighting off influenza A.
Yeah. A couple of black-eyed Bigfoot children.
Telepathically communicating.
Yeah, of course. You mind if we come in and use your satellite phone? Nice job, Rob.
Well, thank you, Rob. I like that. All right. And our next one, we go to the skies.
Okay.
With Charlie. And he says, hey, Bill, I've been a listener to your podcast since the early days, and I'm a proud owner of one of your autographed books.
Oh.
I'm an avid bike packer, where I strap my camping gear onto my bike and I ride on overnight trips or multi-day trips. It's an activity that my sons like to do with me, but I often go alone because my adult son now lives across the country, mm-hmm. and my younger son is just getting strong enough to do some short rides with me.
Mm-hmm.
I live in Atlanta, Georgia, and I like to go bike packing on the Silver Comet Trail. That was once a railroad track that goes northwest of Atlanta. Along the trail is a small campsite set up for bike packers that I often ride to. I've had some experiences, and I've found evidence of possible Bigfoot activity in the area. But on my last solo trip in mid-March, I had a possible UFO or UAP encounter.
Huh.
On Friday, March 15th, I drove out to Dallas, Georgia, and started my bike ride. I went 22 miles through the Georgia woods and reached a campground in an early afternoon. I strung my hammock between 2 trees and then spent some time gathering firewood. I cooked some dinner and sat by my small campfire reading a book. At about 9 o'clock, I decided to go to bed and put out my fire. I got into my hammock and my warm sleeping bag. I usually set up a tarp over my hammock when I go camping, but because the forecast called for clear skies, I left it at home. I spent about a half an hour playing a game on my phone until I was feeling sleepy. I put the phone down and looked up at the clear sky above me. The trees did not have leaves yet, so most of my view of the sky was unobstructed. When I looked up, I saw a cluster of about 6 or 7 white lights above me, the bare branches of the oak tree that the other end of my hammock was tied to. They were larger and higher. These objects were larger and higher than the stars. In a millisecond that my brain registered the existence of the lights, they all shot off in different directions and disappeared. For the next half hour or so, a light would turn on, shoot across the sky, and shut off, and then turn on in the same small spot again and shoot off in another direction. I watched them over me and caught them in my peripheral vision all over the sky. Sometimes they'd change direction during flight, always in a straight line, no curving turns. Sometimes they made right angle turns, but the lights would only be on for half a second or so before turning off again. From my perspective, the lights seemed to be high in the sky, like the altitude of airplanes. As I was watching the lights, a couple of airplanes flew over about 15 minutes apart. Neither airplane deviated its course or otherwise noticed the lights as far as I could tell. By profession, I am a nursing school instructor. I teach critical thinking and using evidence-based scientific research to establish best nursing practices. I teach that scientists have to be skeptical and not fall prey to confirmation bias. Therefore, I'm unwilling to call the lights aircraft or spacecraft until I rule out other possibilities. My first thought while watching the lights was that it might be meteorites that I was seeing, like a meteorite shower. Also, the lights were changing direction in flight, so unlike meteorites.
Yeah.
Yeah. My next thought was that the perception was of the lights were, that the perception was that the lights were much closer to the ground than I thought they were, and they might be some kind of insect like fireflies. The lights always remained above the treetops. The temperature was in the mid-40s, and fireflies in North Georgia don't become active until the warmth and humidity of the summer.
Yeah, that's true.
When I went home, I did research about fireflies in Georgia, and I cannot find a species that shines bright white that's much brighter than the stars.
Yeah, yeah.
I tried to take a video of the lights with my phone, but the quality was so poor that they were not visible at all. The lights are UFOs in the sense that they are flying objects that I couldn't identify, but I'm not sure that I'm ready to call them alien spacecraft.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I love the show. Keep up the great work.
Yeah.
Pretty cool.
Yeah, and that was my first UFO encounter down over the Great South Bay. I saw this thing move, and I initially thought it was a satellite.
Right.
And the movement of it, the speed, matched many satellites that I've seen.
Right.
And all of a sudden, this thing freaking stopped. Mm. While I'm watching it, it stops. And I'm like, no. Then it started going this way and that way. Hard right angles, like an Etch-a-Sketch.
Mm.
And then this thing took off, man. It got some giddy-app going up northeast. It must have been doing 20,000 miles an hour when it took off.
Mm.
Just like, wow, you know, and I was like, wow.
Wow.
And, you know, I knew what I was looking at, you know. I mean, I wasn't imagining anything. You know, Kev, we got eyes to the skies and everywhere else. I'm pretty sharp with identifying and looking at things. And this was no satellite, and it was no plane that belongs to our arsenal.
Yeah.
You know. So I can appreciate people riding in and being perplexed as what they're seeing, because there's stuff going on that we don't have an answer for it, you know. We don't have an answer for it. And we're seeing that at Skinwalker, right?
Yeah.
They're filming these orbs going into the mesa and coming out and moving around and appearing in a quick frame of
See them many different times, see them in the daytime, at nighttime, like crazy stuff.
Yeah. Saucer shapes, orbs, yeah. Other things that look like they were constructed and then they just disappear.
Yep.
Very bizarre stuff going on. So, but
yep.
Hey, look, this is what keeps us coming back. You know, we don't know. People are seeing things and we don't have answers for them. We're just speculating, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. All right, but thanks for writing in about that UFO. And one more email, Bill, this one from Bill in Taylor, Mississippi.
Okay.
And he says, "Hey, Bill and Kev, I live in Oxford, Mississippi, which is about 5 miles from Taylor. Oxford's the home of the University of Mississippi, otherwise known as Ole Miss."
Mm-hmm.
Get that cowbell out.
That's what I'm talking about.
Ding, or is, ding, that, ding, or ding, is ding. That Mississippi State? I think that might be Mississippi State.
I'll bring out the cowbell anyway.
There's nothing wrong with a cowbell. Oxford has kind of a spread out towards Taylor. Taylor does have a famous catfish place there where everyone loves to eat, called Taylor Grocery. The dogman encounter in Taylor that you guys talked about on the Lockett homestead has been mostly forgotten in these parts. There have been more recent accounts of sightings, though, one being from a lineman in the late 2010s. He was trapped in his bucket truck until these things ran off. Wow. Anyway, if you want to ask or know anything else, just reach out. I'll do my best to answer your questions. Great show. Keep up the good work, y'all.
Yeah, I want to ask, do you have any more data on the lineman trapped in his bucket truck with dog men down below him?
You're going to, you know, Bill from Taylor, Mississippi, you're going to have to reach out to my brother again via the website, BigfootTerrorInTheWoods.com. Contact us and give him your phone number if you want to talk to him, and he'll reach out and give you a call.
Yeah, that's, can you imagine being up in your bucket and you can't come down because...
No.
Some type of ornery critters are underneath you?
Boy, oh boy. No, thank you.
What if they start to shinny up the extension arm to the bucket? Then what do you do? Yeah. Oh, man.
So hey, that's it, Bill. Good podcast. Good to be back. We're rocking and rolling again.
Yeah, no, interesting. You know, some really strange stuff. The listener mail today was really bizarre. But we get them. Keep them coming, folks. If you've seen something, say something. Or just write in to say hello, you know.
Yeah, but, or if you have a photo of a Snellergeist, we're interested.
Yeah, Snellergeist. And by the way, folks, go out and buy a copy, audiobook, paperback, you know, support the effort. A lot of time and work goes into... what I'm doing here, so, you know, show a little support and go out there and grab a copy or two, you know. And by the way, if you should find yourself camping out in the wilderness, Western Maryland, Appalachia, Montana, wherever you may be, you better remember just one thing, my friends. Always carry more gun than you think you're going to need. Sleep tight.